Welcome to Historical Nerdery, the show that destroys the myths of the American Revolution, one podcast at a time. I am your head nerd, Alexander Kane. On today's episode, we'll discuss what happened to the New England and New York Loyalists after the outbreak of the American Revolution. I hope you will join us today on Historical Nerdery. Let's get into the show. Following the outbreak of hostilities in 1775, many members of the so-called Patriot faction from New England and New York believed that those loyal to the crown were internal foes who needed to be carefully contained. Sensing the coming crisis, many loyalists started to flee to Boston, New York City, and northward to Canada so as to avoid continued persecution. Of course, those who remained behind were subjected to increased scrutiny, physical and verbal abuse, and repeated interrogation before committees charged with identifying and incarcerating those loyal to the king. One such example of discrimination and violence towards loyalists comes from the seaport town of Newburyport, Massachusetts. William Jackson professed his loyalty to the British crown and remained inside Boston during the siege. When the British evacuated Boston in March of 1776, he escaped on board the brig Elizabeth. While off the coast of New Hampshire, three Continental Navy vessels, including the Newburyport-built USS Hancock, captured the vessel. The Elizabeth was escorted into Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and sold as a prize. The next day, Jackson, as well as other loyalists, secured passes from New Hampshire authorities to travel to Boston to petition for protection from abuse and the return of their confiscated property on board the Elizabeth. After traveling approximately 20 miles south by carriage, the party arrived in Newburyport. Upon entering the Wolf Tavern, word quickly spread about the presence of a loyalist party in town. An angry mob quickly gathered and descended upon the tavern. Horrified, Jackson and the other loyalists quickly sought the protection of Newburyport's Committee of Safety. According to Jackson, "We sent for the Committee of Safety to appease them, but all to no purpose. Finding ourselves in such a situation, we complied. The committee, not thinking it safe, they appointed a guard of 5 men and obliged us to pay the expense the rest of the journey. The bodyguards did little to protect them. The small band of refugees fled Newburyport and proceeded to Boston, being 40 miles on foot. Upon arrival in Boston, Jackson and the others were quickly arrested and imprisoned. The next year, Jackson was tried for the crime of attempting to profit from the distress caused by the American Revolution. He was convicted and ceremoniously banished from Boston. Understandably, when Loyalist men fled to the safety of British lines, many expressed a belief that their wives and children would be spared from the political violence because they were innocent bystanders. As Loyalist Captain Alexander MacDonald opined, "Surely the people, the rebels, has not got so barbarously mad as to molest or hurt a poor innocent woman and still more innocent poor children." Unfortunately, such a view was summarily rejected by the enemy. Rebel committees and colonial governments concluded that unless there was evidence to the contrary, the families of fleeing male loyalists, including women, shared in the guilt. By fleeing prosecution, possibly joining the enemy, and participating in often vicious raids against rebel New York and New England frontier communities, loyalist men had tainted not only themselves, but their families as well. Many rebels demanded punishment of those loyalist men who fought against the cause of independence. Unfortunately, these men were in Boston, Canada, New York City, and other safe havens. As a result, many Americans directed their attention towards the loyalist families who were left behind and began to see them as vipers living in their midst. Over a short span of time since the commencement of the American Revolution, it was the women and their families who bore the brunt of the rebels' rage. Women and families that were branded as loyalists were subjected to various forms of punishment, the most common and devastating being the confiscation of their property. Looting and destruction of loyalist property was also an accepted practice. Finally, many loyalist families faced imprisonment and violence at the hands of local mobs. Loyalist Sarah McGinnis of New York enjoyed a close relationship with neighboring Mohawks. At the outbreak of the war, New York rebels offered her 12 shillings per day and a guard of 15 men if she would try to influence the Mohawk on their behalf. Instead, she and her family provided military intelligence to British authorities and assisted Loyalist refugees with their flight north. In retaliation, local so-called Patriot officials arrested her son and plundered her property. Sarah, her daughter, and her granddaughter watched as rebels sold at public auction all of their possessions, except what would scantily support them in victuals and clothes. Immediately afterwards, the three women were imprisoned in a local fort and treated so badly that Sarah's granddaughter later died. Sarah and one of her daughters escaped at night with only what they could carry on their backs. Tragically, Sarah was forced to leave behind her son, who was out of his senses and bound in chains, and who sometime afterwards perished. Loyalist Philip M.P. was subjected to many insults and abuses from rebels, and was eventually imprisoned with his three sons in a local jail. When the four escaped, rebels turned their eyes towards his wife and seven remaining children. They were quickly arrested, and their property confiscated. Mrs. M.P. and her family were eventually released, but when she returned to her home, she was beat and abused by four men who left her on a road. Although she was rescued by friends, she later died. Elizabeth Carey was a resident of the New Hampshire Grants, now Vermont. Her family had been victimized by the Green Mountain Boys in the 1760s. She watched helplessly as a rebel mob ransacked her home in 1776. In the middle of winter, the outlaws, as she described them, again broke into her home and ordered her family to leave. Although it was snowing and cold, she had no other choice. Looking back while on her way, she saw the outlaws moving her furniture and provisions from the house and loading them into a wagon. Next, she witnessed them open her feather beds and shake the feathers from the ticks out the window and put the ticks and the bedclothes into the wagon. Having finished with her home, the mob then moved on to the homes of other Loyalist tenants in the neighborhood. Shortly after his escape, Loyalist Daniel McAlpin's property was seized, and his wife and family were arrested. His wife, Mary McAlpin, described her family's treatment at the hands of rebels in vivid language when she petitioned the British Crown for compensation in the late 1780s. From the day her husband left to the day she was forced from her home, the captain's house was never without parties of the rebels present. They lived at their discretion, and sometimes in very large numbers. They destroyed what they could not consume. Shortly after the capture of fleeing Loyalists, a group of armed rebels with blackened faces broke into the McAlpins' dwelling house. They threatened Mary and her children with violence and of instant death. They confined them to the kitchen while they stripped every valuable from the home. A few days after this, by an order of the Albany Committee, a detachment of rebel forces came and seized upon the remainder of McAlpin's estate. Afterwards, Mary McAlpin and her children were taken to a unheated hut located in Stillwater and locked inside without fire, table, chairs, or any other convenience. Hoping that the hardship would eventually break Mrs. McAlpin and induce her to beg her husband to honorably surrender, the rebels kept Mary and her children in captivity for several weeks. Mary McAlpin refused to comply and instead responded that her husband had already established his honor by a faithful service to his king and country. Enraged, rebels seized Mary and her oldest daughter, stripped both of them down to their shifts, and carted both of them through the town of Albany as they were pelted with dirt and rotten vegetables. As the violence, imprisonment, and looting continued to mount, many Loyalist women recognized their situation was becoming desperate. In a letter to her husband, John, Mary Monroe described just how dangerous her situation had become. "For heaven's sake, my dear Mr. Monroe, send me some relief by the first safe hand. Is there no possibility of your sending for us? For you can have no idea of our sufferings here. Let me once more entreat you to try every method to save your family." In a second letter, Mary reiterated her desperate situation when she declared, "My dear John, I hope when you receive these few lines, they may find you in good health. Your dear children are all well. As for myself, I am in a poor state of health and very much distressed. I must leave my house in a very short time, and God knows where I shall get a place to put my head in. I have scarcely a mouthful of bread for myself or children." Ultimately, Many Loyalist families concluded that they would be safer by withdrawing to British-held territory north in Canada, Boston to the east, or south in New York City. Despite popular misconception, Loyalist women and their families generally did not gather their belongings and flee into the night. Instead, many had to appear before local rebel committees of safety or similar organizations and request permission to leave the community to join their husbands. Rebel officials carefully scrutinized petitions of Loyalist women and then set strict terms regarding their departure through an order of removal. Loyalist families were also subjected to severe restrictions on what they were allowed to take when they departed from their community. For example, in Vermont, Mrs. Jeremiah French was escorted to the east side of Lake Champlain following her departure from her community. The notice ordering her removal specified that she could take with her only two feather beds and bedding not exceeding 8 sheets, 6 coverlids or blankets, 5 plates, 2 platters, 2 basins, 1 quart cup, and knives and forks, if she had such things, and her own and her children's wearing apparel. The rest of the movables belonging to said estate were to be sold to defray the charge of transportation. When Loyalist Aleida Van Alstyne fled to New York City, she was only permitted to take with her bedding, 2 chests, 1 trunk, flour, wearing apparel, and some household furniture. At first, many communities were reluctant to release Loyalist families as they served a useful purpose as hostages. From the rebel perspective, the continued presence of Loyalist families under their careful guard could deter future military attacks, stem the flow of young male recruits into Canada or New York City, and encourage the release of American prisoners held by British authorities. However, following General Burgoyne's invasion of 1777 from Canada into New York, many local committees recognized that hostages would not prevent future British raids and agreed to release Loyalist women and their families. Likewise, the decision to allow women and their families to flee was prompted by financial concerns, including a reluctance to care for indigent Loyalists. Many states also took proactive measures and also passed laws ordering the expulsion of Loyalist families from their territories. The Albany, New York County Commissioners wrote to the governor in July of 1777, asking that women whose husbands are with the enemy may be sent to the enemy lines. And again in 1779, the state requested the removal of a Mrs. Tuttle, whose husband Stephen had gone off to the enemy some time ago. The Loyalist flight to safety was challenging, with the trek north to Canada perhaps the most difficult. When Loyalists left their communities and decided to travel north to Canada, they usually followed one of two routes. Loyalists from New York typically followed an overland route through Native American territory to Lake Ontario. Because much of the travel was along forest trails, Indian guides were essential. Unfortunately for many refugees, the route included passage through territory held by the Oneidas, an ally of the Americans. Likewise, refugees had to avoid Continental and militia detachments that actively patrolled the region. Once clear of enemy territory, refugees crossed Lake Ontario or followed the southern shore of the lake to the Niagara River. The trip along the Niagara was often difficult, especially in time of spring floods. Those refugees from the Hampshire Grants or New England typically followed a combined land and water route along Lake Champlain and on to Montreal. The roads followed were often muddy and in poor condition. Refugees could only use pack horses, ponies, or hand and horse carts for their belongings and provisions. Securing water transportation was critical to the flight north. Often refugees were forced to seek shelter on insect-infested or low-lying islands in the middle of Lake Champlain. Because of the difficulties of this combined land and water passage, Loyalists were forced to travel in groups whose members could share the burden of carrying boats and provisions. Some Loyalists might be lucky enough to make the trip in 13 days, but most took much longer. An expedition of women and children that had to move slowly was not lucky enough to make good connections with boats and experience bad weather could take from 2 to 3 months to reach the Quebec province. The delay in travel, combined with the rugged country, took its toll on the clothing of Loyalist women and children. It was not uncommon for refugees to exhaust their supplies and be forced to survive on nuts, roots, and leaves. The experience of Loyalist Mary Monroe highlights the hardships Loyalist women encountered during the Revolutionary War. Monroe had been forced to flee from her home in the Hampshire Grants and flee to Canada following the defeat of Burgoyne. As they traveled towards Lake George to join others en route to Canada, they lightened their load by discarding food and most of their wearing apparel. After much difficulty, they arrived at Lake George and laid in the woods 6 days where they almost perished with cold and hunger, until three other families arrived. Afterwards, they prevailed upon the commanding officer at Fort Edward to give them a boat and a flag so that they could set off across Lake George. Unfortunately for Mary, they were discovered by a party of Indians from Canada who pursued them. As a result of the excessive hardships they underwent, Mary and her children were very sickly the whole winter after arriving in Canada. The toll the journey took on Mary was sadly announced by her husband when he declared, "The children recovered from their illnesses, but Mrs. Monroe never will." Thank you for joining us today on Historical Nerdery. To learn more about the Loyalist plight following the start of the American Revolution, as well as other neat information about Revolutionary New England, be sure to check out my website, historicalnerdery.com, follow me on Facebook and Instagram, and subscribe to my mailing list. I'm Alex Kane, and this has been Historical Nerdery.